Well, it's good to see everybody. Can you hear me all right in the back and in the corners? I'll project a little. And I know last week we were away, and we got to go up to Ohio and see Pam's folks and my mother. But it's good to be back. It was good to listen to Dr. Glenn Ward online. Did a great job last week. And if you didn't get to hear it, you need to, because obviously this class did. He taught about being happy, and they're so happy back here. I just can't stand it. You know, I feel like we ought to be over there. But it was, I'm sure, a great lesson. This morning, we are going to pick back up on our study of the life of Joseph. If you go ahead and turn to your Bibles, we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 40. But just some recap for us as we get back into the flow of the study. We've watched as Joseph has really gone through it. He's gone from being the favored son status at age 17 to being betrayed by his brothers, sold as a slave into Egypt. We've seen even as he was in Egypt, he rose to some level of prominence in Potiphar's house, trusted by Potiphar so much that Potiphar had no concern for anything going on in his home. Joseph was in charge, but he also gained the attention of Potiphar's wife. And that obviously turned out poorly after she consistently tried to seduce him, and he persistently refused. She being spurned in many ways, turned it on him, lied about him, and Joseph, we left him in prison last week or 2 weeks ago in chapter 39. Verse 20, Joseph's master took and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and there he was in prison. And yet we are also encouraged because verse 21 from chapter 39, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. So that's a little catch up on where we are in Joseph and his life. We've watched him become a change actually from Hebrew youth who was sold as a slave to now a young man in Egypt. He has, in our study, we don't often get to see, but it's almost Moses seems deliberate in the way the chapters are broken down later. With every chapter, we've got passing of time, passing of time. So just to make sure we're tracking with this, Joseph now, not 17, but probably 27, 28 years of age. And here he is still in obscurity, sitting in prison. But he's had two dreams. The dreams of his sheep standing and all the other sheaves of wheat bowing down to him. The dream of the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowing down to him. Two dreams to show him the certainty of what God was going to do. And yet he's still languishing. He's still not seeing God's plan for his life become fulfilled. So that's where we pick up with Joseph in chapter 40. And again, we see this passing of time thing. Verse 1, sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them into custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. We'll stop there for a second. Let's just unpack that, because what we get right here, some time has passed again. Joseph is aged. Joseph is languishing. Joseph is still wondering. Joseph likely, most likely, knowing what we see of his character, is praying. God, when's the way of escape going to come? When is your plan, your purpose for my life actually going to come to fruition? So while he's here, while he's languishing, he still has hope in God. He still has trust. He still has faith. And now as we see chapter 40, the attention turns slightly away from Joseph, but onto two of Pharaoh's chief officers, the cupbearer. Remember Nehemiah, the cupbearer to the king? This isn't just the guy who sampled the wine, and if he didn't die, it was okay for the king to drink it. This was also a trusted confidant, an advisor to the king. So this is one of Pharaoh's top aides. He's in the inner cabinet, the inner circle, and so is the chief baker. But we're told they somehow committed an offense against Pharaoh. The word there in English is a little bit too weak compared to what it is for us in Hebrew. Literally, this was a crime against the state. We're not told what it was, but there was something so offensive that the Pharaoh is outraged. So much so that he takes his two trusted loyal advisors who maybe have somehow at least raised a question of doubt about their loyalty to Pharaoh, and he's put them in the king's prison. Well, this is where we can now, looking back at the record given to us in Scripture, we can appreciate and understand. This is a divine appointment. Remember, we're studying the life of Joseph, but we're seeing the hand of God. God is at work in Joseph's life. God is at work in every circumstance. God has ordained all things that Joseph is going through, including pagan officials getting sideways with Pharaoh himself. So now here they are, they're put in the prison, the very prison where Joseph is. This prison happens to be right underneath Potiphar's house. Let that sink in for a minute. I'm Joseph. I'm in prison underneath the house because she's upstairs. And she lied. And now I'm in the dungeon in the pit. Makes sense because Potiphar is the captain of the guard. He is the head henchman for Pharaoh himself. He is the one responsible for all the political prisoners. If there's anything going on that's going to be a threat at all to Pharaoh, it's his role to take care of it. So now underneath his nose, literally, underneath his house is the dungeon where Joseph is, where other political prisoners are. We're told that's where all the king's prisoners were kept. And then specifically, we're told about two others, the cupbearer and the baker. And we're told that verse 4, the captain of the guard, that's Potiphar himself, appointed Joseph to be with them, to attend them. And they continued for some time in his custody. Let's make sure we are tracking with what that tells us, because what we've seen here is something of a movement. We know Joseph's character stands out. When he was in Potiphar's house, before he was lied about by Potiphar's wife, Potiphar trusted him so much that he put everything under his care, everything in his charge. Now he's put in prison. But the keeper of the prison, who is someone other than Potiphar, but the keeper of the prison sees what Joseph's character is. He sees what kind of a man he is. He trusts him. He puts everything under his charge. Now Potiphar himself, again, remembering the character of Joseph, when these two high-level prisoners are thrust into prison, the cupbearer and the baker, Potiphar knows the man he can trust. He can't free him because his wife is still living with him. But he can trust him. So he puts Joseph in charge. Joseph, we're told, attends to these two political prisoners. That word is actually a deeper word than we might understand. That same word is used with relationship to the role that Joshua had with Moses. He was his attendant. Elisha to Elijah, he attended him. And now Joseph to two of Pharaoh's top advisors. The word points to someone that is rendering personal service to a person of high importance, prominence, or rank. Now we can understand something of how Joseph's character is seen, even by pagan leaders who just can't deny who he is. So with the first four verses sort of as a backdrop, why is this divine appointment included here in Joseph's story? Why is this so important that we see this detail of God actually working through pagans to affect something in Joseph's life? Oh, we know the story well enough. Many of y'all have come to me and said, oh, I'm so glad you're teaching Joseph. Joseph has always been one of my favorite characters. We know the outcome. I've worked really hard. Every commentator I read cannot resist going to the end of the story with every chapter that they write. I'm trying not to do that with you as we walk you through it. I think we gain something if we can try to live through Joseph's life as he did in real time. He didn't know how God was going to work. He just knew God was going to work. But here we are, and we see Joseph, a man of character, with this divine appointment recorded here at this point in Joseph's life. Joseph's character is proven. We see the movement happening. We see, though, that God also is on the move. Recently, the ballet did The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Aslan is on the move. He is moving throughout Narnia. Narnia is not fully restored yet, but God is working. His plan, his timetable, nothing will thwart. So it's important for us to see the context as to why chapter 40 is where it is. Verse 5, one night, they both, the cupbearer and the baker, had a dream. Each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, why are your faces downcast today? And they said to him, verse 8, we have had dreams, and there's no one to interpret them. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me. Here we see a cultural aspect as well as a theological aspect. Culturally in Egypt, it was believed that dreams actually could foretell the future. Something is about to take place in your life because of a dream. You've had those dreams, haven't you? You've had that dream and you wake up and it seems so real. I remember as a kid, I used to dream about bees. I hated bees. I literally ran out of the bed because of dreaming about bees. It was so real. And then I had to remember, there's no bees in my bedroom, it's just a dream. Well, this is more than just a dream. In the culture of Egypt, it was believed, actually volumes were written, that the gods would reveal the future through dreams. How to interpret dreams, 101, 201, and so on. You can become an expert in interpreting dreams. Well, here we have two Egyptians in their culture who have dreams. It's like they wake up one morning and they look at each other. Hey, Ralph, how did you sleep last night? Oh, not good, man. You wouldn't believe the dream I had. You too? And here we go, and the conversation unfolds. This dreams that they had seemed so real. And seeming so real, they looked around and they realized, we're lacking someone we need. You see, in Egypt, they were professional interpreters, trained. They had degrees in dream interpretation. But there was none here in the prison. So they're very troubled. Joseph walks in that morning. They've discovered that they both have had an awful, frightening type of a dream, very unsettling dream overnight. Joseph walks in. Now remember, Joseph is also a prisoner. Joseph is literally probably one of the very fewest prisoners who are really innocent in jail. And he walks in, and rather than being self-absorbed and self-consumed, he takes notice of these two that have been in his custody. He's observed them. He's been a student of them. He knows how they act. He knows how they interact. And he sees something different. He's saying, hey, guys, you guys really seem down this morning. What's going on? And they simply share, we've each had a dream, and no one's here to tell us what the dream means. And Joseph wisely points not to himself, but to God. It says, don't dream interpretations belong to God. Tell them to me. Well, we see here what we find out in more detail next week in chapter 41. I will give you a slight forward advance, all right? A forward look, spoiler alert. Pharaoh, with his dreams, looks for someone in whom is the Spirit of God. Joseph has been gifted with the ability of the Spirit of God that he now, not just being a dreamer, can be the interpreter of the dreams. No longer just dreaming, he can actually understand. He can describe. He can tell. He has a prophetic gift. So that when he hears the dreams, he knows it's up to God. God is the one who interprets dreams. Tell me what they are. And with confidence, he asks them to share the dream. So here we have verse 9, the first dream, that of the chief cupbearer. He told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's hand. There's his dream. Straightforward, three vines. Suddenly, almost miraculously, they bloom, they get fruit, the fruit's ripe, I'm pressing it into the cup, and I'm putting the cup right back into Pharaoh's hand. And here is the immediate interpretation that Joseph gives. This is the interpretation, verse 12. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, And you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cup bearer. Joseph is certain of the outcome. This is not just some vague, amorphous interpretation. Well, yeah, something good's going to happen to you at some future time somewhere down the road. He is very specific. Because God, the Spirit, has given him exactly what this means. It's not 3 months from now, it's not 3 years from now, but in 3 days, your head's going to be lifted up. That is a idiomatic statement. You're going to be brought before the king, the Pharaoh. You're going to be put in the court. And before the king, your head's going to be lifted up. You will look him eye to eye. And when you do, he is going to pardon you. He's going to restore you. And Joseph is actually quite so sure of this that in verse 14, he doesn't just give him the interpretation, but Joseph takes advantage of this opportunity and he makes a request. Verse 14, only remember me when it is well with you. And please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh. And so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. And here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit. So Joseph, listening to the dream, also realizes that this could be an opportunity. And there's principles here for us. You know, we pray and we trust. And there are times in our lives that as we're praying and trusting and we're seeking what God's plan and purpose is, what he's going to do for us next, either with a crisis we're facing or just a decision we have to make, Lord, what are you going to do next? Sometimes, as we are praying, it's easy for us to forget that God at times uses us or others in our lives as part of the answer to our prayers. Here Joseph is. He's been looking for the dreams he had as a 17-year-old to come true. He knows with certainty because he had the dream twice. God didn't just give him a dream. Over these years, he's understood the reality, the certainty of what those dreams meant and how somehow it was going to play out. And now as an interpreter of dreams, he looks at this dream and he can say, this may be how God will answer my prayer. When you are before Pharaoh, remember me graciously. Remember my character when you were with me. Remember how I treated you. Remember how I spoke the truth to you. And when it comes to pass, I'm so certain it's going to come to pass. When it comes to pass, plead my case to Pharaoh so that I can get out of here. And then he goes on. We see the graciousness even of Joseph in this. He doesn't blast his brothers. He simply says, I was stolen. I was kidnapped. I didn't do anything wrong to deserve what I got and get down here in the first place. And then even while I'm here also, here in this house, I didn't do anything wrong, but here I am still in this prison. How gracious he was even as he made his case. Remember me to Pharaoh. And with expectation, he shares with this man not only the interpretation of his dream, but his own request. I think there's a good takeaway for us. And that's there's always a balance for us between God's sovereignty, what he is doing, and our responsibility. And I think Joseph understood that. God was sovereignly working. There was a plan in place. But Joseph saw this as an opportunity to say, my responsibility is to communicate the message. And maybe this is how God will work. I will trust him still. So Joseph, locked away in obscurity, knowing the dreams would come true, looks at this as an opportunity and he boldly asks and trusts that God would work. Well, right about this point, the baker is listening. This is working out okay. My dream really had me rattled, but maybe if I tell him my dream, it'll have a good outcome too. Shares his dream. Look at it beginning in verse 16. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, I also had a dream. There were three cake baskets on my head. And in the uppermost basket were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head. And Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you. I didn't want to hear that. Yeah, time out. Can't you be a little nicer? You know, couldn't you just, you know, sugarcoat it a little? You know, it was a bad dream. It was a warning of the wrath to come. We might think, Joseph, you should have, you know, backpedaled a little. No. See, the message wasn't Joseph's. He was the messenger. The message was God's. God giving dreams to these pagan leaders was also still working, not just in their lives, but in Joseph's life. Because the reality of what Joseph predicts coming true in each of these men's lives is what later will bring him to Pharaoh's attention. It proves that he's a prophet. For a prophet to be true, his prophecies have to come true. Both of these come true, and without a doubt, we see the prophetic office in Joseph. So here the dream is given, the interpretation is applied. In verse 20, the reality takes place. On the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all of his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. Verse 22, but he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. 3 days pass. Can you imagine these two guys? Having heard the interpretation of their dream, the cupbearer, with every moment of each day, he's getting a little more excited, a little more excited. Wow, I can't wait. And if you're the baker, those 3 days just kind of drag on. But the 3 days passed, and it's Pharaoh's birthday, and it was a custom. All of the high-ranking officials, even those in prison, would be required to celebrate his birth. He brings them into the courtroom. And by whatever means, he determines the innocence of the cupbearer and restores him to position. And by whatever means, he determines the guilt of the baker, and he executes him by cutting off his head. And then hanging his body. We think of hangings as a rope because of our culture. In this day, a hanging would have been a stake and your body impaled. Put in public for all to see, where the birds could then eat the flesh and pick your bones. Rather gruesome. And yet exactly how God, through Joseph, would prove that Joseph was his man. So as we think through what we've seen even this morning, we might think that at this moment, the cupbearer, it happened just as he said. I'm going to go to Pharaoh. I'm going to tell the story. I'm going to say there's a guy down below. He's amazing. He's got character. He served me well. He cared about me when he didn't really need to or shouldn't have, but he really personally cared about me. And Pharaoh, he's not even guilty. I can prove it. We need to do something about it. That might be what we expect, but verse 23 wraps the chapter up. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. One author I read this week said, how quickly we forget in prosperity those who were true companions in adversity. Out of sight, out of mind. Here he is, he's restored. Perhaps he fears crossing Pharaoh again. For whatever reason, though, day after day goes on without any mention of Joseph. Now, each week, remember, we're talking about Joseph, not only to look at his life, but Joseph as a type of Christ. Here's a good time for us to consider Joseph, even in this chapter, as a type of Christ. Here Joseph is with fellow prisoners who, like the two thieves, crucified beside Jesus. One is saved and the other condemned. And here Joseph says, remember me when it's all well with you, before he was quickly forgotten. But the thief on the cross said, remember me when you come into paradise. And Jesus said, today you will be with me in paradise. Even the very message of the gospel, the message of Christ himself, a message warning of the wrath to come is foreshadowed here. Because Joseph didn't just give the message of life, he gave the message of death. We are told that the gospel is the aroma of life unto life, but also the aroma of death unto death. When we share the truth, the unmitigated, not watered down truth of the gospel, it will to some produce life. And to others, it'll just condemn them to their death because they will reject it. Here's the type of Christ. Having considered that, though, I want us to wrap up with a different focus. Where was God while Joseph was languishing in this prison? Time is going to transpire between this chapter and chapter 41. Joseph remains in prison, forgotten. Where is God in this? Couldn't help but think of an author I read years ago, sharing a personal story. He shared a story about when he was 3. He wanted to prove how big a boy he really was, that he could, at his granddad's house, go upstairs and use the bathroom all on his own. He didn't need help. So up the stairs he went, into the bathroom, closes the door behind him, goes to the bathroom, does everything he knows to do, washes his hands, everything is good. He's feeling really pumped about himself until he tries to open the door, and the door's stuck. Well, this self-confident little 3-year-old is suddenly temper tantrum all over the place. Get me out of here. Granddad comes up, and the door's so stuck he can't open it from the outside either. Now it's temper tantrum times 3. He is really panicking because he doesn't know what in the world is going to happen until he hears a sound outside the window of the bathroom. And he realizes it is his dad putting a ladder against the house, coming up the ladder through the window into the bathroom, and he takes his little son by the hand, opens the door, walks out, and he plays the rest of the day. Well, that's a neat story, right? Except the author went ahead to apply it to my life. He said, what if in the circumstance you're facing that you can't get out of, God simply climbs up the ladder through the window into your room, turns off the light, and sits there beside you? Is God alone enough? And is God enough when you're all alone? See, I think Joseph had to walk through that. Still in obscurity. The plan didn't go as I thought it would. Lord, it looked so real that this was going to be my way out. Day after day, week after week, month after month, still sitting in the dark. John Calvin talked about it this way. To paraphrase him a little, God, before he opened the door for his servant's deliverance, entered into the very prison and sat down with Joseph just to sustain him with his strength. As we go through our lives and we face those moments that feel like those prison cells, those difficult things, those challenges, those adversities, those setbacks, and it feels like, God, where are you in this? It's good that we know God is still working behind the scenes. We know God's ways are not our ways. We know He is working even when His ways are hidden from our view. But maybe it's good for us to be reminded that when God doesn't work the way we think He should work, or when we think He should work, He's really working to increase our dependence on Him. To help us learn not to measure His salvation by our own feeble sense. William Cooper, English poet, contemporary of John Newton, Amazing Grace, actually was encouraged often by Newton because Cooper struggled ever since he was one of 2 sons out of 7 that alone survived the infant mortality rate. And his mother died when his younger brother, John, that survived, was born. He struggled with depression all of his life. God brought him to Himself in salvation. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that take care of it? Well, sort of, but not completely. He still wrestled with the darkness of his soul. But listen to what he wrote. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. God's working in each of our lives. We've been highlighting throughout the study of Joseph the impact of generational sin. And back in Exodus 20, we're told that the sins of the father are judged even to the third and fourth generation. But that verse goes on. But for those who love the Lord, 2,000 generations is God's blessing. You see, what we also need to see in Joseph's life is not only how do we deal with generational sin, but how do we deal and pursue covenantal faith, personal faith. Because Joseph is suffering the consequences of his brother's sin. Everything that's happening to him is because of them. And because of dad playing favoritism for all those years, this is all because of sin. And yet God is at work. And God is taking a young man into a young boy into a young man, and he's forming in him the character of the leader he wanted. Because God is a God of covenant faith. Just saw a wedding where the daughter of friends was married this weekend, and in that wedding, both sets of parents stood up and they gave a covenantal blessing to each of their kids. I think they understand. The covenantal blessing is one generation at a time, one person at a time, one event at a time. It's for us, like Joseph, to look to God and be strengthened by him. It's not our circumstances. It's the reality of God at work in us. That's what carries us every day. Father, would you help us? Help us to remember and to know, to trust, to believe, to be sustained and to be encouraged and even fulfilled by the reality that no matter what the situation is that we're facing, no matter how difficult it really is, you're still in control. And you are still at work in our lives, deliberately effecting your plan, your purpose, for your glory, for our good today and tomorrow and the next day. And Lord, whether you come into the situation of our life and you give us immediate release, or whether you come into the scenarios of our lives and you say, trust me, I'm here. That's all you need. Let us believe it and come to the one that we need. Let us bring you honor and glory as you deepen our faith. In Jesus' name, amen.